What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
It was like a ghost. I saw its eyes, shining white eyes, and it dove down underground.
A first-year opinion here, but gotta be a dragon, right? Maybe a Peruvian viper tooth or a Ukrainian iron belly?
You would know that terminology, Josh. The Harry Potter prequel, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, not, you'll be shocked to hear, among my most anticipated movies of the fall. But the Thanksgiving release is one that many Muggles are looking forward to. This week, our top five questions about the fall movie season, plus some thoughts on new releases Hell or High Water and Kubo and the Two Strings. That and more.
North American Thunderbird. It's a Thunderbird. Shining white eyes, looks like a ghost. Thunderbird. Go ahead and quote me.
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is supported by Film Spotting listeners, including new $5 a month donor, Rosalie in Naperville, Illinois. Thank you, Rosalie, and thanks so much to all of our monthly subscribers.
There's also a no-cost way you can help the show. Rate or review us on iTunes. Thanks to Amore001 and Mr. Waterpolo, who posted quick reviews over the past week.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh. I'm Adam. And after a couple more weeks away from each other, Josh, we are reunited here on the show. We give sincere thanks to Tasha Robinson and Angelica Jade Bastien. Both were fantastic guest hosts. In fact, they were so good, maybe we should just alternate weeks.
More vacations
forever.
Ahead.
More vacations.
That's okay with me.
Somehow I don't think our listeners would mind. And speaking of vacations, do you want to enlighten me and any of our listeners on where you went? Did you have any fun?
Survived tubing behind a speedboat in Wisconsin, which I think is an accomplishment at my advanced age. So, and you barely survived kayaking on the open ocean in
True.
Puerto Rico.
Yes.
So
I lived to tell.
I didn't realize how risky it was that we would be reunited. This is really something.
There was a chance this would never happen, but apparently we really don't belong on the water. It's true. You went to Wisconsin. I went all the way to Puerto Rico with my entire family. My mom, actually, who grew up there from ages 3 to 14, went with us. So that was a lot of fun. We
Very
actually went
cool.
back to her old street and her old house, and she's talking about her friend that lived right across the street. And guess what? She still lives there.
Really?
And came out, and they recognized each other.
Was it a surprise, or did
yeah,
it?
Yeah, totally. It was completely a surprise. And we managed to spend most of our time in Puerto Rico on the coasts. And the best day I had, I got to tell you, Josh, was the excursion we took snorkeling, and we went out to an island, which here's my loose tie-in to the show. The day before going to Old San Juan, we had an Uber driver, and she asked what else we were doing, and I said, well, tomorrow we're going to Culebra Island. And she said, oh, Culebra is like a movie. It's incredible. And it is. It's about an hour out on the water, but once you get there, just crystal blue water. It was a perfect day. The waves were just right for hanging out on the water and having a few drinks and sand, you name it. The perfect beach experience. So.
Yeah, sounds like paradise. I've been able to do that a couple of times, not in Puerto Rico, but other places, and it is amazing. The one time we did that, B lost a tooth in the
wow.
water, got a little bloody, and we were in one of these snorkeling pens where nurse sharks were at the bottom.
Love it.
But, you know, we were told they don't bother humans. We survived.
More water horror stories to share here, Josh. Well, we did manage to catch up with a few movies during our time away. We both saw Hell or High Water, which opened in limited release to really good reviews last weekend. We'll give that a couple of minutes, Josh, and you can weigh in on Kubo and the Two Strings, which opens wide this weekend. And I've even got a Golden Brick contender to nominate. All that plus Massacre Theater later in the show, and podcast listeners will get our thoughts on the sixth film in our contemporary Nordic Cinema Marathon, 1001 Grams, from writer-director Bent Hammer from Norway.
So basically, we're just squeezing in all the shows we missed together the last few weeks into one.
Yeah, right. So maybe we're being so reflective on the fun we've had this summer as we're recognizing that very soon the leaves are going to be turning to brown. We are going to look ahead to the fall movie season and do it the way that we do it here on the show, or have been doing these previews lately, where rather than just listing arbitrary titles. And I say arbitrary because we're basing it on a director or a few cast members, a plot synopsis,
maybe a peek at the trailers.
Yeah, exactly. We are instead going to explore what's ahead through some questions we have about all the films we saw on the docket for September, October, and November up to Thanksgiving. And there is a little bit of irony in this, Josh, where we have always traditionally stopped our fall preview at Thanksgiving so that we could then have a holiday movie preview. And there were occasions where we did a holiday movie preview. And we have since, for about 2 or 3 years at least, abandoned those holiday previews. So I'm not sure why we stop it at Thanksgiving still, but that just does seem more fall-like to me.
Well, things get a little busy towards the end of the year, and there's a lot of reviews we want to pack in, but it's nice to have in our back pocket, too. Right?
That's true.
Okay.
You never know.
So let's say we're doing that.
More vacations to contend with, and we need an easy top five. Probably not going to happen, though. Before we get to our lists and our questions, we thought it might be fun to look back at some of these previous lists from this year. We're looking at fall, but we did a preview for summer. We obviously know the answers, or mostly know the answers to those questions. And at the start of the year, back in January, we did a top five looking ahead to the entire year. Let's start with summer, Josh, since it's closest in our rearview mirrors. What were your top five then, and what are the answers?
Okay, I'm just going to give you a few here. One's related to a question I asked actually at the beginning of the year when I said, never mind peak TV, have we finally reached peak superhero? In the summer, I asked, will Suicide Squad right the DC ship?
Right.
I think we have our answer for both of those, and it involves Suicide Squad. I'm ready for a break.
That was like the superhero epitaph.
Oh, man. I mean, we'll see. I don't know when the next one is. Doctor Strange?
Yeah, maybe? Coming out.
Is that? Yeah. So we'll see how I feel in a month or two. But right now, yes, we are at the peak. I don't need any more. Another one I asked in our summer preview, can Ewan McGregor play Jesus and Satan? This
you
was for
yes.
Last Days in the Desert. Absolutely. It's one of the top performances of the year for me so far.
Still a movie I need to catch up with. My five summer movie questions were, will Ghostbusters be significantly better than its terrible trailer? The answer?
And?
No, at least for me. Will Scaredy Cat Adam finally see a Purge and or a Conjuring movie? I didn't make time for either.
And it's gone right now.
Yeah.
I was thinking about catching up with it, and it's right in the middle of theatrical release and video.
My number three, which movie will delight and disturb the most? This was your favorite question, Josh. Wiener or Wiener Dog? Inspired stuff.
The
I
Wiener
never did
double
see,
feature. You
I
didn't complete
did
the Wiener
see
double
Wiener
feature?
Dog. I didn't see the Solon, so I can't chime in, though. I did talk about Wiener a little bit, the documentary about Anthony Wiener, and basically came down on the side of little more disturbing than delightful. Can Woody Allen win me back with Cafe Society?
Yikes.
Hard no.
You had a
hard
rough
no.
summer.
Yeah. And number one, will the nice guys elevate Ryan Gosling to comedic genius status?
There you go.
It didn't hurt his cause anyway. He's remarkably funny in that movie. So that was summer. There are some of our answers. Did you look back to that list from January? Did anything stand out that you could actually weigh in on?
Well, I'm with you on Ghostbusters. I asked in January if the reboot would top the original. I liked it more than you did.
Yes, you did.
I was favorable on Ghostbusters.
And you love the original.
And I don't love the original, but I do think the original is a little bit better. The other question I asked, which I don't have a personal answer to yet, is will Jodie Foster finally make her mark as a director with Money Monster?
Did you even see it?
I didn't see it because the initial reviews were brutal. But then a few came out in the weeks after that were fairly high on it. Tasha Robinson from The Next Picture Show, I know she was a big fan. So I'm definitely going to now catch up with it rather than let it completely fall by the wayside.
I'm definitely going to let it fall completely by the wayside.
Come on.
Zero interest. Of the five questions I posed back in January, only two have come to pass. The first one, which debaucherous duo will be more dynamic, Elvis and Nixon or Russ and Roger? And I don't know if this movie's still coming out or coming out this year anyway, but the Russ Meyer, Roger Ebert movie.
That's right.
About
Forgotten
making
about
Beyond
that.
The Valley of the Dolls. Will Ferrell, I believe, going to star in that movie, and I don't remember who the other star is. I want to say Josh Gad for some reason.
That sounds
really,
right, yeah.
I should have looked this
Ebert.
Up. Elvis and Nixon, a reference to Michael Shannon playing Elvis with Kevin Spacey as Nixon. I did see that film and was mostly disappointed by it, though they both give really good performances in the film. And the other one, will we reap the rewards of directors working outside their comfort zones? This was inspired by Michael Shannon's longtime collaborator as a director, Jeff Nichols, and making a sci-fi movie, Midnight Special, a movie we both liked.
Mm-hmm.
I like quite a bit, even though I would probably say it's my least favorite of all of his films, but that's just because I like the other films so much more. Stepping outside his comfort zone paid off there, and my prime example was Ira Sachs's movie Little Men, a director who's made Keep the Lights On and Love is Strange, which was one of my favorite movies of the year it came out, both movies dealing with homosexual male characters, and here he's making a movie largely about two teen boys, or kind of adolescent boys and their families, and a bit of strife that they go through. So different, though, now that I've actually seen Little Men, and it's not coming out here in Chicago, I think, until September 2nd, but I did see it recently, and it fits completely in with Ira Sachs's body of work. So a little bit of a departure, perhaps, but definitely a rewarding film, and we may review that film on an upcoming show. That brings us then to the questions that we will attempt answers to as we get through the next several months. Josh, your number 5 fall movie question.
Will The Witch negate Blair Witch? 1999's The Blair Witch Project got a surprise sequel. It was one that was kept under wraps until it recently played, and it was called, during this screening, The Woods. That was at Comic-Con. Now, I was an early adopter of The Blair Witch Project. I was able to see it before its theatrical release, so this was well before it became that challenge movie, you know, people went to prove they weren't going to be scared. It absolutely terrified me, and I haven't revisited it much since because I'm terrified about the prospect of doing that. I did pick it as my number one movie of 1999 because I do think this is much more than a stunt. There are some distinct formal choices made in the filmmaking that are why it's really so effective. Now, Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2.
Terrible.
From 2000, not so much.
Really bad.
Terrible is the word. So this new Blair Witch, in which the brother of one of the original characters goes into the woods to find out what happened to his sister, this is going to have to overcome both our bad taste from Book of Shadows and the challenge from a certain witch movie from earlier this year that currently sits on my 2016 top 10 list. That would be Robert Eggers' The Witch. So perhaps against my better judgment, I'm eager to find out how this one fares. We'll see. It's coming up pretty quickly here. Opens September 16.
What is that?
The guy who uploaded this video said it was from a tape he found in the Black Hills woods. I think that might be my sister.
You really think your sister could still be out there after all these years?
If there is any chance that I could find out what happened to her, I need to try.
Definitely want to see that movie as well. My number 5 ties back to a question that Genevieve Kosky from The Next Picture Show posed on that January episode. In her 5 questions looking ahead to the year, she asked, will Hamilton creator Lin-Manuel Miranda become the youngest EGOT winner ever with Moana? So this was pre-Hamilton, me seeing Hamilton on Broadway. I barely knew what she was talking about, honestly, at this point. And now, of course, that I've seen Hamilton and become obsessed with it like most of the rest of the world, my question is, will any of Hamilton's genius be on display in Moana? And it's not really a fair question to Miranda or to everyone else involved. He isn't the showrunner here. He's not the master creator. He's just doing the music and doing it in collaboration with others. Mark Mancina, and I hope I'm saying this somewhat correctly, Opetaia Foai. And you've also got the directors, Ron Clements and John Musker. These are accomplished animated film directors. And the trailer tells you right from the beginning, this is a movie from the creators of Frozen, Zootopia, and Big Hero 6. All 3 pretty good movies. The reality is, though, Josh, I think there are probably a fair number of people out there like me who, unless I'm taking my kids or they're really excited about it, I'm not necessarily getting really excited about the prospect of an animated Disney movie, and I'm going to be more inclined to go because of Lin-Manuel Miranda's involvement. And this film stars Dwayne Johnson, described as a once mighty demigod who goes out on an adventure across the ocean with a teen girl. If you watch that teaser trailer, the song in the teaser, I would say, is unmistakably Miranda. Of course, it does have his voice, but the soaring chorus, and there's a key line in there. We are explorers reading every sign. We tell the stories of our elders in a never-ending chain. Hamilton, among other things, is about legacy. Who lives, who dies, who tells your story, as we hear at the finale of Hamilton. So I think there probably were a lot of narrative reasons and thematic reasons why this material spoke to Lin-Manuel Miranda beyond it just being probably a pretty lucrative gig and another challenge for him. Speaking of Hamilton, Philippa Sue, who, say it with me, Josh, plays Eliza.
And, I'm going to let you do that.
Yeah. Jemaine Clement is in the movie as a 50-foot crab. And Taika Waititi, he of Hunt for the Wilder People, highly recommended on last week's show with Tasha Robinson. He wrote the original version of the script. I don't know how much of that remains intact, but we'll see if it has any of his sensibility as well. It comes out November 23rd, so just right before Thanksgiving.
So a ton of talent there. And in terms of audience, what you said makes me think this might help. Miranda's involvement might help a demographic that a Disney movie of this type doesn't always get, which is older teens.
I mean,
those are the ones who are obsessed with Hamilton right now, and maybe it'll draw them in as well. Okay, my number four question has somewhat to do with all the talent involved. And I find when we do these previews, I usually have one movie where I ask some variation of this, where the cast alone is so promising. So here I'm asking, can masterminds be as funny as the people in it? So listen to this lineup, all right? Ghostbusters, Leslie Jones, Kate McKinnon, and Kristen Wiig. They're joined by Owen Wilson, Zach Galifianakis, and Jason Sudeikis for a crime comedy about an armored car guard who organizes a bank robbery.
Okay, I'm sold.
Now, the poster for Masterminds, it already had me laughing because it identifies Owen Wilson as the brains. So I'm intrigued right there. One complaint, if you think back, I know you don't want to do this, Adam, but think back to Ghostbusters. And one complaint about it was that it would have been nice to see the likes of Jones, McKinnon, and Wiig working together with material that wasn't so concerned with franchise care, right? Just let them be funny rather than being straight women for the likes of Slimer. Well, they have that choice here. They have that chance, at least, with a few other talented comedians as well on board. The director is Jared Hess, and it's interesting that he's working from a group script that he didn't have a hand in. He usually writes with his wife, Jerusha Hess, as they did on Napoleon Dynamite. Now, I run kind of hot and cold on Hess, so for me, it's really the cast that holds the promise here, and Masterminds opens September 30.
Yeah, I had completely overlooked that one, but that cast does sound great, and that's going to nicely transition into my number four question of the fall movie season, which is, can J.A. Bayona and I make up with a Monster Calls, or is reconciliation impossible? See what I did there?
Yeah.
Josh?
Yeah.
Okay. This is Bayona's follow-up to The Impossible, which was the follow-up to a movie we both loved, his debut, The Orphanage, and the storytelling theme following on the heels of my number five pick, Moana, is going to continue here. It's a movie about storytelling as a means of coping. It's about a young boy named Connor. His mother is dealing with a terminal illness. She's played by Felicity Jones, and he's getting bullied at school, and he comes across a monster who befriends him and tells him stories and becomes his friend. Not necessarily the movie I would expect next from Juan Antonio Bayona, but I still have so much faith in him because of The Orphanage, a movie that gave me one of my top five scariest scenes when we did that list. It made my top five 21st century horror movies, and that movie, certainly a film as well about coping with trauma and a family in crisis, The Impossible, yes, was about that too. But I think Bayona was handcuffed by the material where he was making a big budget disaster thriller with stars. And it showed anyway for me. I hope this is a return. And one of the reasons I'm optimistic, Josh, is the cast, along with the boy who plays Connor. He's a newcomer named Lewis McDougall. You've got Felicity Jones, as I mentioned, Toby Kebbell, Liam Neeson, and Sigourney Weaver.
You want to know what my number three question is? Is it related?
Wait.
Will a Monster Calls bring me, Adam, and Juan Antonio Bayona back together?
Love it.
I can't believe you
highlighted this movie. We'll find out October 21st.
You're right. Things among the three of us used to be good. The Orphanage. We were all on board with that. But man.
Big happy family.
What happened with The Impossible? That was one of our most contentious splits, I think.
Knockdown, drag out.
Episode 431. And, you know, speaking.
Don't search for it, though.
Speaking, yes, what I was going to say, of show milestones, we're coming up on 600 and thinking back about that. That episode marked my first year anniversary. We didn't celebrate it very kindly.
No.
It's a rough, rough listen. You know, A Monster Calls, I'm surprised you're highlighting because this sounds more like my cup
of
tea.
It does.
Than yours. The IMDb plot description just says a boy seeks the help of a tree monster to cope with his single mom's terminal illness.
Mm-hmm.
So, hey, you had me a tree monster. You know I'm going to go for that. You?
That should be on a t-shirt.
We'll see.
Josh Larson, you had me a tree monster.
I hope so. October 21, we'll find out.
All right, my number three, I didn't plan this, but in keeping with the number, I've got three questions for you, Josh, but all about one movie. All about one movie. Bear with me.
Go.
Will the Year of the Hawk continue, a.k.a. how will Nick Pizzolatto transition from HBO to the big screen, a.k.a. will The Magnificent Seven force me to finally watch The Seven Samurai?
You have not. How
you know this. It came up on our blind spots. It's like my biggest embarrassment in the show history that it's one of those movies going back.
That is right.
To like my college days. I vaguely remember seeing.
Okay, the blind spotting show. Yeah, we talked about this.
Yeah, it's on the list. It's something I badly need to rectify. I can't believe I'm even bringing up the indignity of it again here on the show. But I have the answer to that question already. Yes, it is. I am going to see The Seven Samurai, though I'm not going to do it as homework. I'm probably going to wait until I actually see The Magnificent Seven, just because we're going to probably review it. If we don't review it, then maybe I'll do it in a little bit of a different order. But they are remaking the 1960 Western, which, of course, in turn was a remake of the 1954 Akira Kurosawa movie. And speaking of great casts, you've got, in addition to Ethan Hawke, back to him in a moment, Denzel Washington, Chris Pratt, Vincent D'Onofrio, Lee Byung-hun, who we've seen in some South Korean films, Matt Bomer also in the cast, along with Peter Sarsgaard, though I think he's maybe the bad guy in this film. But
of course
always,
he is.
Yeah, but always a compelling presence on screen. With this movie, I am more excited to watch Denzel do Denzel things than I am to see Ethan Hawke. But Hawke has had a great year, picking up where Boyhood and some other projects left off. Very good in Maggie's Plan with Greta Gerwig. Amazing. One of the performances of the year in Born to Be Blue. And also a really good turn in a movie I'm going to talk about here in a little bit, The Phenom, which came out in June of this year. I'm a fan of the ensemble, as I mentioned. I'm a fan of Western, so it has all that going for it. And I mentioned Nick Pizzolatto. He is the creator, the writer of every episode of True Detective, I believe season one and two. I loved the first season of True Detective on HBO. I even enjoyed the bulk of the second season. And I know at the height of all the hoopla around True Detective, he did some interviews and people thought maybe he was a little bit pretentious in the real meaning of the word, like too self-serious, but without any of the substance to back it up. He did or did not come off that way in those interviews. I don't really care. I loved what I saw on the screen each week when I watched True Detective. And I do think he offered a much more complicated view of masculinity than he might have gotten credit for. I have a feeling that will transfer over in some way to the subject matter in The Magnificent Seven. Though I'll note, he gets screenplay credit, but apparently others were involved, as happens so often in Hollywood these days. So
yeah, project
who
this
knows?
Big,
yeah,
right.
Who knows all the permutations this script has gone through, and who knows if it really has any mark of his whatsoever. The director is Antoine Fuqua, who everyone remembers from his collaboration with Denzel on Training Day. And one final Ethan Hawke note, he's got another fall movie coming out that I'm excited to see, October 21st, In a Valley of Violence, the latest from Ty West. So good director, and maybe we'll see another really good Ethan Hawke performance. The Magnificent Seven comes out September 23rd.
Heard a lot about you. Said you were beautiful. Good.
Being good at this kind of work is not very beautiful.
What are you doing?
Testing you, the way you tested me.
Do they trust you?
I'm very good at pretending, Max. They're watching us. Now kiss me.
All right, my number two question. Is it a good idea for Brad Pitt to step in the shoes of Humphrey Bogart and Cary Grant? Brad Pitt is a movie star and a formidable actor, I'd say. I think you've even come around on that little bit, right, Adam? But with Allied, this is from director Robert Zemeckis, he's asking to be directly compared with some of the legends. This is set in 1942, and Pitt plays an intelligence officer who meets a French resistance fighter in North Africa and then reunites with her later in London. The resistance fighter is played by Marion Cotillard, who is easier to imagine, I think, in the likes of Casablanca, Notorious, To Have and Have Not, which Allied is clearly trying to draw upon, than maybe Pitt is.
Yeah, she's got that timeless quality.
She does, in both her appearance, her physical appearance, I think, and her acting style. Mm-hmm. So I would say, though, Pitt, he continues to surprise us throughout his career, both on screen and as a savvy producer, too. So I'm willing to give him a shot here. I am really looking forward to Allied. Opens November 23.
All right. My number two question is, will camera person be my favorite movie of all time, merely my favorite movie of 2016, or this year's The Wolf Pack. The Wolf Pack, you may remember, Josh, mm-hmm. I think you saw it at Sundance.
That's right.
Is the movie that, just based on its description, was by far my number one most anticipated movie, I think, of last fall, maybe of the entire year. It's a documentary about six brothers who have spent their entire lives up to their early to mid-20s. Some of them are still in their teens, but being locked away in their Lower East Side of Manhattan apartment. Their father will not let them out. And everything they know about the outside world, they've taken from watching movies, in particular a lot of crime movies like Reservoir Dogs. And they dress up and they stage these immaculate recreations and they film them. And then I watched the movie and it was just okay.
Yeah, not a lot there.
No, there's not a lot there. It was not nearly as provocative as its premise. Well, here's Camera Person. This movie has been on my radar for a little bit. It comes out September 9th. I'm going to read to you the description that IndieWire offers in an article we'll link to in our show notes. I think it was just published here today, the day that we're taping this episode. They offer 34 indie movies to keep an eye on this fall. They write this of Camera Person: the hand of the cinematographer is not supposed to be felt, which has certainly been the case with Kirsten Johnson, who has shot some of the best documentaries of the last 20 years. Johnson has gone back to the dozens of films she shot and found unused footage where the viewer does get a sense of the person behind the camera, the nervous negotiation of trying to get a dangerous shot with director Laura Poitras, comforting a scared and pregnant single mom, a sneeze that shakes the camera. Pieced together, the footage becomes an unusual and surprisingly affecting portrait of a woman who has spent her life capturing images around the world while simultaneously being a meditation on what it means to film nonfiction / reality. Truth in documentary filmmaking, truth in life, all the subjects that, for whatever reason, appeal to me most. And there is something inherently fascinating, I think, Josh, of seeing all the unused moments from various projects, capturing the drama. And people talk about this all the time with documentaries, that they're inherently subjective, no matter how fair they try to be, simply because they're making choices. Mm-hmm. A filmmaker is making choices in the edit. So we're going to see some of those choices, some of the things that were left on the cutting room floor, and the story those moments tell, and the meaning we draw from them as viewers, the meaning that documentarian, the cinematographer who was behind the camera in those moments, the meaning she draws from them now, could be incredibly provocative and could be my favorite film of the year, or, as I said, maybe my favorite film ever, or maybe it promises to be fascinating and just doesn't quite pull it off like The Wolf Pack.
Let's hope it's at least somewhere in between.
Yeah.
Okay. Number one, my number one question for the fall movie season: is mainstream America ready for a black historical figure who isn't a suffering saint? I'm going to give you a couple titles here: 12 Years a Slave, Glory, Hotel Rwanda, Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom, even Selma to a degree. I think these are Black History Month movies. They're good ones. And in the case of 12 Years a Slave, I would say a great movie. But they're also safe in the sense that they center on a victim hero in almost every case. Now, there are exceptions to this Hollywood tendency. Of course, Spike Lee, think about, he didn't go this route with Malcolm X at all. I think that's one of the reasons that movie has such a rabble-rousing power to it. Now, since debuting to huge acclaim at Sundance, The Birth of a Nation has been described in ways that remind me of the reception to Malcolm X. This is a movie that comes at you. That's what we've sort of been hearing since this January. It's Nate Parker's historical drama that centers on the deadly 1821 slave rebellion led by Nat Turner. And as you can tell by its title alone, which is a power grab from D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation, this movie isn't looking to play nice. After another summer of heightened racial tensions in the U.S., I think it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out in theaters when it gets a wide release. Now, the swooning at Sundance led to a record $17.5 million deal with Fox Searchlight. They're releasing The Birth of a Nation on October 7. I can't wait to see it.
My number one fall movie question is this: which flawed hero will make the best movie about heroism, Mel Gibson or Clint Eastwood? And I use both words, flawed and hero, in quotes, because we certainly could spend about 20 minutes at least wrangling over what both of those words mean, especially as they apply to both of those men. I am intrigued by their respective movies. With Gibson, it's Hacksaw Ridge. For Eastwood, it's Sully. But I am also intrigued by the difficulty increasing, it seems, in reconciling the artist with the art. How do we navigate that relationship? Both of these men are venerated actors and filmmakers who have obviously often played heroes on screen. And over the past couple of years to a decade or so have had their reputations tarnished. Eastwood less so. He's been just kind of crotchety and generally expressed some politically incorrect opinions that haven't gone over so well. Obviously, with Gibson, it's a little bit more complicated. I'm not going to enumerate all of his transgressions, partly because you can find them if you do a Google search. And there's a great article on Vulture all about Gibson that's called Are You Ready for Mel Gibson's Comeback? And it's not so much about Hacksaw Ridge. It's actually about his performance in another movie. I think it's called Bloodfather that's coming out. And I'll link to that in our show notes. But again, heroes who have been tarnished and they're making movies about, for lack of a better word, questionable heroism. Take a movie like Sully. I heard that that movie was coming out a few months ago. Really had no interest in it. In fact, when you first hear about it, you know the story, the pilot who landed the plane on the Hudson River, apparently saved all those lives, and you think, okay, how are they going to build a movie around that? And then this might have been, Josh, a month or so ago. I was sitting with a group of guys who I don't normally talk about movies with. Somehow movies came up, and someone mentioned that they're making a movie about Sully. It's going to come out. And one of the guys at the table said, yeah, you know, I've got a friend who's a pilot, and he was telling me how he doesn't understand why they're making this guy into a hero, why they're making a movie about him. He didn't really have to land that plane. He had an engine that was still working, all this stuff. And I'm going, oh, I don't remember hearing any of that stuff. That's really interesting, though, that there is this impulse. I remember it when we reviewed Into the Wild here on the show back in, I think, 2007. Not that what Christopher McCandless did was necessarily this heroic act, but a lot of people saw a nobility in his venture out into the wild. And then all these people, rightfully or not, decided that they were going to set the record straight and point out to the world how there was really nothing noble about it. He was an idiot. And some people, it almost seemed like they felt like he deserved to die because of his stupidity. It reminded me of that a little bit. And then I go see the Sully trailer for the first time. And that's the entire trailer. Basically, that conversation, that story that that friend of mine told me is what that whole trailer suggests the movie is about. And I do think we just have a capacity as people, mainly, primarily as Americans. I am curious if our non-American listeners have a different perspective on this, to raise up and tear down our heroes. We immediately look for something to find fault with after we've already elevated them. I think that's something interesting to discuss. Hopefully these movies will be interesting to discuss as well. Sully comes out September 9th. Hacksaw Ridge, the Mel Gibson film, is based on a true story of a medic in the Army, Desmond Doss, who was a Seventh-day Adventist. He was a conscientious objector, obviously refused to take any life, but decided to join the war effort anyway and be someone who tried to save lives as a medic. Hacksaw Ridge comes out November 4th. Now, and this all ties back to your number one choice as well, the conversation about flawed filmmakers gets way more complex and serious in light of the revelations just over the weekend about Nate Parker. Some details surfacing about a rape charge when he was a student at Penn State in 1999. Of course, he's not as established a filmmaker or public persona as Eastwood or Gibson, and the accusation against him is far more objectionable and troubling than any of the other two's offenses that I'm aware of. So it certainly didn't seem really right to wedge him into my mostly tongue-in-cheek comparison, but this dialogue about the struggle of separating the art from the artist is only going to get way more intense over the next couple months leading up to the release of Birth of a Nation, a movie that I, like you, can't wait to see. In terms of pure anticipation, it's the movie I'm most excited about.
Brethren, I pray you sing a new song. Sing praise in the assembly of the righteous. Let the saints be joyful in glory. Let the high praise of God be on the mouths of the saints, and a two-edged sword in their hands to execute vengeance on the demonic nations and punishments on those peoples, to bind their kings with chains. Dishonor have all his saints. Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord. Sing to him a new song.
Those are our top five fall movie questions. Any honorable mentions?
Well, I'm wondering if Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children is going to be the equivalent of Alice in Wonderland Tim Burton or Edward Scissorhands Tim Burton. I still haven't entirely given up on him. Adam, a little bit of hope there. I mentioned Loving from Jeff Nichols. I wonder if this is going to be his deserved mainstream breakthrough. And then what is Michael Fassbender doing in Assassin's Creed?
Good
the
question.
The video game adaptation.
I can't believe that didn't make my list.
I know it's directed. I'm pretty sure it's directed by his Macbeth director. So there's a relationship angle there. But and maybe the movie will be great.
I'm sorry, I know the answer. I live by the creed. Never question Michael Fassbender.
Okay, I got it.
We work in the dark to serve the light. We are assassins.
Another question. What is London Road? This is in the IndieWire article, and I'll just read you this sentence. Astonishingly, the play used the writer's verbatim transcripts from people she interviewed who were involved in tracking a serial killer of prostitutes on London Road. Okay, follow me here, Josh.
Mm-hmm.
Which she edited into a sung musical that the actors had to execute precisely.
Okay.
Tom Hardy is in it, along with Olivia Colman.
And this is the movie version.
London Road. It comes out.
It was inevitable there would be a movie version of that.
Why is Jesse Plemons so captivating on screen? He's coming out in a comedy called Other People. You remember, I really hated the movie Black Mass, but I was flipping channels, I think on Sunday afternoon, landed on HBO. It's on. I had completely forgotten that the movie opens with him.
Yeah,
it's about his character's indoctrination into the Winter Hill Gang.
Possibly the best part of the film.
It probably is. And I'm just entranced by it.
There's a lot of really good character actors in that
film. There are. And that first 15 minutes with Plemons is fantastic. Which literary thriller will thrill the most? The Girl on the Train, based on a really popular bestseller, and Nocturnal Animals, the follow-up to A Single Man from Tom Ford, which has a manuscript and an author as pivotal points in its story. How trippy will a Terrence Malick documentary be? Voyage of Time, his first documentary.
IMAX, right?
Coming out, I think, in IMAX in October. And I don't have a question. I just can't wait to see it. Another one I found out about in the IndieWire article, October 14th. It's called Christine, stars Rebecca Hall, and it's directed by Antonio Campos, who made Simon Killer and After School, two really interesting films. And this is based on the true story of a broadcaster, this is all new to me, in 1974, who killed herself on air. And that's who Rebecca Hall plays. The article calls it a career-defining performance for her, and she's always good. So.
Yeah, I mean, she's definitely capable of a huge performance in an important film.
Those are, again, our top five fall movie questions. Share yours. Email us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Usually Massacre Theater is USDA certified as organic, but we're going to make some modifications when we play next. Stay with us.
Oh, if I had a dollar bill, yes, I believe I surely will. Go to town and drink my fill early in the morning. Little darling, she's a redhead thing. Man, she makes my legs too sing. Wanna buy a diamond ring early in the morning. Her mother was a golden girl, slit her throat just to get her pearls. Cast myself into a world before a bunch of swine. It's a long way down the Harlan Road, busted back in a heavy load. Won't get through to save my soul early in the morning.
By the power vested in me by the District of Columbia, I now pronounce you husband and wife.
A clip there from the trailer for the upcoming film, Loving, a movie that was not a factor in any of our questions for the fall movie season. Certainly a movie we are highly anticipating, Jeff Nichols' second film of this year based on a true story. And Josh, if you just step outside, maybe you did notice it on your way in. There is a sign on the studio door that says, it's been 0 days since we screwed up a film spotting poll question.
What's our record for that sign? Not very good?
No, it's maybe 2 weeks tops. The current film spotting poll question, which is available to be voted in now at filmspotting.net, is asking you to choose your most anticipated fall movie based on a true story. We gave you what we thought were the cream of the crop of the fall movie options, including Oliver Stone's Snowden, Clint Eastwood's Sully, Peter Berg's Deepwater Horizon, and Sundance hit Southside with You. Of course, The Birth of a Nation in there as well. All very good options, but according to Film Spotting listeners, we missed a big one. We've already alluded to it.
Andre Cadeau said, of those options, I would choose The Birth of a Nation. However, if November 4th is considered a fall release in the movie universe, note it is, then I would pick Loving. This is Jeff Nichols' second release of 2016 and is based on the Virginia interracial couple who defy the state law that bans marriage between blacks and whites.
Kate Fueo, I'm voting for Sully as most interesting trailer and Birth of a Nation as most likely to be an actually interesting movie, but no Loving option? I know I'm probably the only one who loved Midnight Special that much, but at this point I'd watch Jeff Nichols filming already dried paint, much less a story this intriguing with a cast this talented, Ruth Negga, Joel Edgerton involved there.
James in Riverside, California said, I too think Loving should have been an option. Should have replaced Southside with You, which opens in August.
Okay, so what he's referencing is there's actually two flaws with this poll question. Southside with You never really should have been involved, although it's close to the beginning of September, doesn't really qualify as a fall movie. And yes, we left Loving out, and we have to give credit to Sam here. He does an amazing job with these poll questions. They are usually the output of his prodigious mind and creativity. He was looking at a list of releases for the fall that was just Chicago releases, and Loving was not on the schedule at that time.
There you go. So it doesn't require a correction.
No, it really doesn't. It was an omission. I don't think that Loving, even though I think it would do pretty well in the poll, I don't think it would change the results as they stand right now. We will share those results next week on the show. You still have time to vote. You can do that now, along with telling us what else we forgot at filmspotting.net. In other correction news, Josh, you go away for a week and all hell breaks loose.
Was this apparently. Me? Was this something I did?
No, you were gone and
okay.
Look at me with a guest host. I make two mistakes. Jeremy Saulnier came up. He wasn't on my list, but a strong contender for top five directors we'd bankroll.
Mm-hmm.
I said in my narcissism thinking that just because that's the first movie I saw from a director that it was their first movie. I said that Blue Ruin, our uh-huh. Golden Brick winner, was his debut. Not his debut, it's Murder Party. Let me say this. I am aware of Murder Party. I knew it was his debut, and I can tell you why. Because I interviewed Saulnier recently, and the entire time I was racked with guilt because I've had all this time to watch his debut film, and I hadn't done it, and I still haven't done it.
And you were terrified he was just going to keep saying,
yeah.
as in Murder Party.
As I did
and
here.
Like,
and I'd have to nod, and
yeah.
thankfully it was a phone conversation.
You dodged a bullet
and he wouldn't
there.
Know. So we wanted to acknowledge that as well. We do have a milestone coming up. Our 600th episode of Film Spotting. We're not going to make as big of a deal about it as we did for 500. We were, as listeners know, planning a live show that's now been pushed to November, and we will have a lot more details about that coming soon. But we're still going to commemorate the occasion a little bit, and we wanted to throw out to you, the listeners, we certainly don't want to get bogged down in a bunch of navel-gazing during the episode or reflection back on the show, but we're curious if there's a single review or a single top five list, or maybe it was an interview, or maybe a marathon, whatever it was, could have just been a really funny line that Josh said that for you defines Film Spotting. Like if you're trying to convince someone Film Spotting is a show they should listen to, or you're trying to explain to someone why you listen as much as you do, what's your go-to? We would love to hear it, whether it's email, feedback@filmspotting.net, or of course you can leave us a voicemail.
Please don't pick that review of The Impossible. That's my only request.
I don't think The Impossible is going to come up. Our voicemail number, 312-264-0744. We just might share some of those comments in that episode. A quick plug. We're not going to talk about Pete's Dragon on the show, but I'm going to talk about it because I did see it this weekend with my kids.
Yeah, lucky you. I want to see that one.
I'm going to appear on Masterpiece Cinema with Josh Spiegel. I've been on that podcast, I think once before, maybe twice. And if you're curious to hear myself and Josh talk Pete's Dragon, you can find the show in iTunes. I assume it will be up around the time that this episode airs. We do have some more movie passes to give away. We plugged these on last week's show, but want to mention again that there's an advanced screening coming up on Wednesday, August 24th, of the latest film from the great Werner Herzog, Lo and Behold, and then the directing debut of one Natalie Portman, A Tale of Love and Darkness. That screens the next night, Thursday, August 25th, here in Chicago. We have free movie passes ready for you to enter and win them at filmspotting.net. Just look in the top story section.
If the film is by Wes Anderson, then it will make his list. Or from Pixar or Disney, well, you get the gist. But heavy-handed messages really aren't his thing. Time for Larson Recommends on Film Spotting.
before I headed out on vacation, I was able to catch a press screening of the new Laika film, the studio behind The Box Trolls and Coraline, among others. It is Kubo and the Two Strings. And it's set in ancient Japan about a boy who's learning of his own past via these fantastical stories told by his mother. And the really cool technique and what takes advantage of the animation here, stop motion, which is what Laika is known for, is that he accompanies these stories with elaborate and magical, really, origami creations. When he plays his guitar, I believe it's called a shamisen, it kind of animates these creations so they have a life of their own. And this is the movie's meta stroke of genius, because you're watching stop motion figures animate stop motion figures in a way. It reminded me of that lovely little detail in Fantastic Mr. Fox, where Ash has a tiny train set in his room. So it's just like getting smaller and more intricate as we watch. Now, Kubo and the Two Strings, I will say, falls eventually into a fairly straightforward adventure plot. There's a trio of sidekicks who get involved. Things get a little unnecessarily complicated in terms of narrative and character, really, too. The storytelling and the character development here, it's just not on the level of something like the best Pixar or even something like Coraline, I'd say. And so that might trip some people up. It did for me a little bit. But still, overall, it marks a significant achievement in large-scale, handcrafted animated artistry, which is what Laika specializes in. There's one moment where Kubo has sent these origami paper birds, so a flock of paper birds, into the air, and they swirl around this bewildered actual bird, a living bird. And as I'm watching it in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, that bird is real, right? Because it's not origami. And it took me a minute for that, till that sequence was over, before it sunk in. No, it was all fake. It was all handcrafted and hand manipulated, but they're so good. And the artistry is so entrancing that, to me, the one real bird was of a completely different entity. So fans of Laika should definitely see this, highly recommend it for that reason.
I can't wait to see it. I have a recommendation of my own, and really, I want to fit this in because I think it needs to be in Golden Brick contention for this year. It's a movie that came out in June called The Phenom that I caught up with on cable on demand over the weekend, but I believe is also available via iTunes and probably some other digital platforms. It is ostensibly a baseball movie, and that's why I avoided it. As much as I tend to like baseball movies, I thought this movie, called The Phenom, saw the poster, a pitcher on the cover. I thought this was going to be a movie like A Million Dollar Arm or any of these myriad baseball movies, the one Eastwood did a few years back about scouts or agents and trying to find the next big young prospect. That is not this movie. The pitcher is played by Johnny Simmons, who you may not recognize by name, Josh, but I know you just recently rewatched Scott Pilgrim versus the World. He's young Neil
in
that movie. He's also a supporting character in The Perks of Being a Wallflower, among many other performances. He's the Phenom pitcher going through a really tough time as he's just been elevated to the majors. Basically, can't throw straight anymore, is just completely wild. He's seeing a sports therapist played by Paul Giamatti, and then we get Ethan Hawke in here as well as the pitcher, who's named Hopper, as Hopper's father. And let's say Hopper Sr. is a little bit of a bad egg who is pushing his son way too hard and has been pushing his son way too hard his whole life. So, of course, during these therapy sessions, you know, at some point, the truth is going to bubble to the surface about that relationship. This is a really good pairing, and for some, maybe this won't be a good pairing with Everybody Wants Some, the Richard Linklater movie from earlier this year. They're both baseball movies with very little baseball in it. The key difference is Everybody Wants Some, of course, is all about the ensemble. It's all about the individual trying to define himself as an individual, but within the context of a team. That's paramount, being a member of that team. The Phenom is only about this individual. Hopper isn't really part of a team because he's different than everyone else. In high school, when we see those scenes, he's different because he's a pitcher, so he's slightly separated from all the other activities.
Yeah, they talk about that
and
Everybody Wants Some.
There you go. And also because his talent is just so much on a higher level than everyone else, that he's treated very differently than everyone else on the team. He's isolated because of that talent, and then he further isolates himself because of the psychological torment his father has been wreaking on him his whole life.
Do you want to be the best?
Yeah, sure.
All right, then. The time is now. Get up.
Yeah, but what time is it, seriously?
is 3:30. It's time to jog.
I had school in 3 hours.
Dude, I'm not going to ask you again, okay? I'm trying to teach you about greatness.
The performances are fantastic. Giamatti, Hawk, as you'd expect, but Simmons, I think, is really good here. He finds a way to play a very withdrawn, isolated, tormented character who has lived his whole life never wanting to betray any emotion. His father taught him that you have to always be in control and you can't let that emotion out. That could then translate to a really boring performance, and it never is. The narrative, as I've suggested, defies every sports movie cliche, makes really great use of its elliptical, nonlinear structure, has a really bold ending that's probably bold because of how non-bold it is on its face. I would love to discuss it with you or anyone else who has seen the film. And just the aesthetic in general. Noah Bushell is the filmmaker, the writer and director. He's made 5 other features going back to 2003, but none of them have been on my radar. Played at the Austin Film Festival. His last one played at Tribeca, but he really uses point of view here to convey Hopper's isolation. There are times where you only see one side of a conversation. Lots of times, frequently, characters look right into the camera, and it just heightens the sense that we as the audience are one with Hopper. We're feeling the judgment and the reproach that he feels in every moment. And the visual style isn't just functional, but it's not too ostentatious either. It relies on the camera as much as the dialogue, if not more so, to evoke mood and meaning. It actually reminded me a little bit of a movie we're going to talk about here in a couple minutes, Hell or High Water, in that regard. So definitely highly recommended The Phenom.
We have a really good list of Golden Brick candidates this year. Doesn't it seem like they've been piling up?
I think
with
we
some
only have
titles?
5 or 6, but they're 5 or 6 really good films. Absolutely. The Phenom, as I said, currently available via cable on demand and via rental on most digital platforms. Kubo and the Two Strings opens wide this weekend. If you see the movies and agree or disagree with our thoughts, email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
We are also going to have some thoughts on Hell or High Water coming up in a bit, but first, Masquer Theater. It's the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance at winning a prize. A couple weeks back, guest host Angelica Jade Bastien and I massacred this scene.
Ah, Mr. Krebs. It's a pleasure to see you. You know, we were getting very concerned. And Barb, it's a pleasure to see you too. You're looking rather buoyant this evening.
Shut up. My fee.
$10,000?
No. The price went up for this one, Schmitz.
We had an agreement.
You told me Krebs was alone and unarmed. He wasn't.
Sure. How could I know that? Bounty hunting is an ugly, unpredictable business. Barb, you of all people should know that. How much?
$20,000. Canadian.
That was Pamela Anderson as Barb Wire and Clint Howard. What a pair, huh? You ever imagine those two would be on screen together as Schmitz in 1996's Barb Wire? It was written by Chuck Farrar and Eileen Chaikin, based on characters created by Chris Warner. The director was David Hogan.
Can't believe I missed out on that fun. That Massacre, part of episode 597, which featured not just Angelica as co-host and Josh's Pam Anderson impression, but a review of Suicide Squad and the top 5 women comic book characters done right.
You know, I had my vocal cords enhanced for that performance and then reduced, though, before I actually went on air.
Uh-huh. Well played.
Hopefully you can tell.
Well, we were curious how many people would dare to enter this Massacre Theater, implicating them as people who have actually seen Barb Wire. Josh, it was not many. I don't remember what the movie was maybe 3 to 6 months ago where we said it was the lowest entered of all time, like 12
it
people.
It was recently.
Entered. This was close. Only slightly more than 12.
And that makes me proud of our audience, to be honest.
Yeah.
That means they're choosing wisely what to watch.
James
not
Hawes,
this.
Yeah, in Montreal says, I'm ashamed to say that I know the scene you massacred came from David Hogan's 1996 epic, Barb Wire. The tie-in is that it's a dubious comic book adaptation. Slick move swapping the gender roles, but I recognize Pam Anderson's sparkling dialogue anywhere, even through Josh's workmanlike performance.
The price went up for this one, Tommy.
We had an agreement.
You told me Rock was alone and unarmed. He wasn't.
Did we really need to relive that? Apparently we did.
Probably not. Dave Anna from Charlotte, North Carolina says the film was barbed wire, which was based on a comic book series and contained a strong female character who wore revealing outfits. I think that was the main point of the movie, and let's face it, comic books revel in that cheesy stuff. Another tie-in, barbed wire got a 40 Metacritic rating, while Suicide Squad is coming in at a lofty 41.
Yeah, and at my last check, it's dead even with barbed wire at 40. From Roger Ebert's 2.5-star review of barbed wire, movies like this stir a certain affection in my heart. The filmmakers must have known they were not making a good movie, but they didn't use that as an excuse to be boring and lazy. Barbed wire has a high energy level and a sense of deranged fun. There's as much sheer work in this film as in films 10 times as good, which is both encouraging and depressing, I suppose.
What? That's not surprising from the co-writer of Was It Beyond the Valley of the Dolls? Is he co-writer on that,
there you
right?
Go. So, You're right. I think so much of that will be a perfect segue into our Massacre Theater this week as we talk about things both encouraging and depressing. And we talk about the sheer amount of work that will go into it, even if the results are unfortunately poor. Not many entries, Josh. You have lots of room to wiggle around in the film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner. Who is it?
Anita Montoya from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Now, how did you miss the opportunity to make the obvious joke, Anita Montoya, you killed my father, prepare to die.
I'm sparing Anita. She probably hears that like
once a month. Every day of her life.
It was Adam, not me, Anita.
Congratulations, Anita Montoya, you killed my father, prepare to die. Email feedback at filmspotting.net to claim your very own Film Spotting t-shirt.
Camera, mite, camera, mesen de, yukkuri to. ね、パッションがカメラ目にはパッションだよ。わかった?
And, with intensity.
Is that everything? I mean, it seemed like he said quite a bit more than that.
Let's go ahead and put in our work this week on Massacre Theater, Josh. And I don't know if we can call this film beloved. We might be picking another movie like Barbed Wire, a bit of a cult classic.
Well, first of all, I don't think Barbed Wire is a cult classic. And I think there will be a lot of people who would be offended that you compare the two. I think this movie has fans of a certain age.
Have you seen this movie?
Yeah. I saw it. Of course. It's like right in our
I just saw it like 2 years ago.
What?
Yeah.
Oh,
I don't know
right.
why I watched it. Why would I watch this movie? There was nothing
2 years
coming
ago?
Out.
That is really, a really good question.
That would necessitate me seeing this
so
movie.
So you were about 25 years late then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically. Well, a little bit of a hint there from Josh if we haven't given you enough hints already. And we can't wait to hear how this scene comes out because we may have our wonderful co-producer Sam Van Halgren decide to have some fun and really heighten the scene by adding some special effects, or maybe the performance will be so good it will be like its own special effect.
Well,
and we won't need it.
It's your part, so let's see.
It is my part, which never bodes well. You're the funny voices guy, but I think I'm ready. Josh, you started off. I'm going to give you the action. Are you ready?
I'm going to try to put a little twist on this, so let me think where I need to be. Okay.
And action.
Hey, hold it right there.
Yes.
What do you mean, yes?
Yes.
That all you can say?
No.
Well, anything else?
Yes.
Positive and negative, huh? You're a bit.
Yes.
Well, where's your program? Isn't he gonna miss you?
No.
I'm your program?
Yes.
Another mouth to feed.
Yes, 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 yes.
And scene.
I think I was about to attack you, actually. I was so in character.
You were one yes over, but otherwise nice.
Oh, man. You called me out. I sometimes like to go off script in improv, Josh. I was in the moment.
Yeah. Okay. Whatever.
If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, August 29th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Put the gun on the counter, you trying to get us killed?
I ain't stealing from some old man. We steal from one place, that's it.
You're turning out to be a poor-ass criminal.
Ben Foster and Chris Pine in that clip from Hell or High Water, a movie, Josh, that up until just today when I looked earlier, for a good 3 or 4 days, had a 100% Rotten Tomatoes rating. Not a single critic decided to voice a dissenting opinion against this film. Alas, it did not continue. At just 98% as of this taping, Richard Brody against Hell or High Water.
Oh, Richard
New Yorker.
Brody, okay.
Yeah, shocker,
no,
I know.
No, it's not a surprise.
And Peter Sobosinski here in Chicago.
Peter, okay.
One of the other dissenting opinions on this movie.
Are you relieved it wasn't me?
Oh, man. I was so happy to see it was you. I didn't want you to go through that hate mail again.
Yes.
And even though you deserve it, I didn't want you to go through that again. This is a film with Pine and Foster. They play brothers. It's set in West Texas, and they set out on a bank robbing spree. We find out as the movie goes along that they have very concrete plans and very concrete motivations for what they're doing. They're not just a pair of thrill seekers. Jeff Bridges plays the cranky, embittered, near-retirement Texas Ranger who gets one last big case before he heads off into the sunset. Last week, when Tasha was here, we had just come from that screening when we came in to tape, and she very eloquently articulated some of the main reasons why this movie is so good. You have since been able to catch up with it. What did you think?
I loved its atmosphere. I think that's what stood out for me. And I went into this with high hopes, having really enjoyed David Mackenzie's Startup. We mm-hmm. both did.
Yep.
And I think that was close to making my top 10 that year. This is, you know, obviously something different, set stateside, whole different milieu, but he does capture just the dead hot air in these towns where the economy has stalled. And it's like the wind has stalled right along with it. There's this iconic shot of Pine and Foster as brothers on this defunct ranch that they own. And they're just sitting there. Nothing's moving. And even the windmill in the background is like struggling. It's rusty. And it's like just struggling to move because there's nothing there. And you can feel that throughout this film. So that was exciting as a movie-going experience. I think the performances are really strong, too.
Yeah.
I mean, Bridges is just on the verge of self-parody here, or maybe Tommy Lee Jones parody
yeah.
from No Country for Old Men. Clearly, he and all the filmmakers understand they're walking in a similar path, and this is obviously not quite that level of a film. But Bridges also has a weariness to him as he gets older as an actor in certain parts, and just the way he hefts around
yes.
his frame as
it's
this
older
guy.
It's one of the real thrills
guy.
Of this
yeah.
movie is
yep.
watching his lack of vanity.
Yes, absolutely. And so I like that. And it's probably unfashionable to say, but I really like Chris Pine. I just find him to be
I've always
this,
liked him.
He's just he's got that charisma, right?
Mm-hmm.
And here he twists it a little bit where he amps it up as Kirk in the Star Trek films, and I enjoy that very much there. But here he's dialing it, almost lowering, you know, he's got those blue eyes and he almost lowers his gaze in this film to try to downplay that
mm-hmm.
and hit some real genuine melancholy. And Ben Foster, you know, I think he's at just about the right volume
he
level
is.
Here for him.
He is.
Because he can be pretty loud.
Yes, he can. And despite how much I enjoy both performances, I did say immediately after I walked out how much I would love to see an alternate version of this film where they switch roles. I'd love to see Ben Foster not be crazy Ben Foster.
Right.
I say that agreeing with you, though, that he's not over the top here. I think he walks the line. He's exactly where this character needs to be. But he is someone, and people love to point out that he recently was in David Lowery's Ain't Them Body Saints, an okay movie. He has a very good performance in that, a very dialed-down performance for him. But there are plenty of examples we can point to of Ben Foster being that huge character. Think of someone like his character in 310 to Yuma. That's fun to watch, too, where he's chewing a little bit more scenery. But I just think it'd be so interesting to watch Foster be the relatively well-adjusted one and
yeah.
watch someone like Pine chew the scenery a little bit. Now, I don't know that I'd actually rather see that film. I just wish they could both exist in the world, kind of like when John C. Reilly and Philip Seymour Hoffman swap roles in Sam Shepard's True West, and every couple nights they'd switch roles on stage. I think that'd be a lot of fun. Unfortunately, can't happen with movies. But Tasha touched on this during her comments, and I want to echo it here. Just how rare it is for a movie, despite it existing within the framework of so many conventions. You can't watch this movie and not think about No Country for Old Men, and specifically Jeff Bridges, and think about Tommy Lee Jones. It's a Robin Hood story. It's a cops and robbers story. It's a cop slash serviceman about to retire story. But not just this summer, Josh. In general, I think we see so few movies that are well-crafted crowd pleasers. And I don't mean well-crafted to please, but smart, sensitive, poignant movies that also really entertain. There are a ton of great comedic moments in this film, mainly from the Jeff Bridges character. And there are also a lot of really tense, suspenseful moments where, this is what Tasha was alluding to with the crowd we saw it with, people in the theater were gasping at certain moments out loud because they're that invested in these characters and in their story. And David McKenzie doesn't really moralize. He doesn't stack the deck too much in anybody's favor. And I think that's part of the reason for the audience investment is that moment to moment, as you reflect on this movie, and I reflect on my experience with it, I was never totally sure whether I wanted these brothers to get away with it or to get caught. All these characters have some nobility to them, but they all have major flaws as well.
Yeah, I will say I think that's very true for the majority of its running time. And then it does hit – the genre gears start to crank a little bit where there's an inevitability to the collision between the brothers and the Bridges character. And so for me, maybe that's part of what might make it crowd-pleasing. But for me, it's also what does have it fall – further behind something like No Country, not that it had to be No Country, when those plot machinations start to kick in. And the epilogue too, which we won't say what it was this weird experience where I enjoyed the two actors in the moment, but I didn't need the scene for the film. Does that make any sense?
No, because I disagree with you. I mean, I disagree completely. The epilogue is one of the real strengths of the film. For me, it's one of those moments that makes it not conventional. It could have been purely crowd-pleasing if it had gone out on the note that other movies would have gone out on, and it ends on a much more ambiguous, difficult note.
Yeah, you probably saw it as more ambiguous than I did then. I saw it as more positioning us towards a certain perspective where what you were talking about earlier, having to choose and not knowing which way to choose.
No, I was just as conflicted.
Okay.
Just as conflicted at the end of the film. And you talk about the cinematography and some of those shots, the brothers framed against that landscape and framed against their farm that really they're out to protect and to keep. The word, I don't know if you used it here or not, I don't remember you saying it, but I know you did in your written comments, menacing. The landscape is menacing and majestic. There's a great sequence at the beginning of the film too, where it opens with a heist and it's a long tracking shot, really neatly choreographed. And the way it's set up, you almost think, because we've seen this so many times before, that we're about to watch a couple of bank robbers who really know what they're doing, are really meticulous, and everything's been planned out perfectly. And just as you're getting comfortable with that, the movie upends it completely. Mm-hmm. And you realize that's not at all how this is going to play out or how this movie is going to play out. My only issue with the film, and I can't get into it because it's a total spoiler, I'll have to be vague and say that the fate of one of the characters in the film, I knew from the first 15 or 20 minutes of the movie because one conversation that takes place. It happens in movies like this all the time.
Right. That,
with these
that's
types
part
of characters.
The genre elements I'm talking about.
And for a movie that otherwise I felt like played so perfectly within the confines of the conventions, but then found ways to surprise us, that was one that felt false. The only false kind of audience manipulation moment in a film that otherwise rang so true. I wish it wasn't there, but it is Hell or High Water out now. Obviously, highly critically acclaimed and recommended by us. And despite, Josh, all that critical acclaim, nobody going to see this movie, sadly. We hope you'll give it a shot. It's playing now in limited release around the country. If you do see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you know how to email us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
We are Norway bound when we come back with a review of Bent Hamer's 1001 Grams. It's the latest in our contemporary Nordic cinema marathon. Stay with us.
Cut my teeth on daddy's old LGO.
Ladies and gentlemen, the mother of all kilograms.
a bit of the trailer there from the 2014 film 1001 Grams from Norway's Bent Hammer. It is the penultimate film, the sixth movie in our contemporary Nordic cinema marathon. It's given us a chance to catch up with a few of the region's most acclaimed directors, Finland's Aki Kaurismäki, Roy Andersson from Sweden, Suzanne Bier from Denmark, and we picked Hammer as our Norwegian delegate. There were certainly a few others to consider. Joachim Trier, a very known quantity and known to us. That's really why we overlooked him. We do use these marathons as opportunities to explore work that we otherwise aren't very familiar with. And going back through our email, as we were setting up this marathon and announcing the titles, we heard from a listener. I'm going to call him Eric. He's from Norway. It's spelled E-I-R-I-K, and he recommended Hammer as the Norwegian representative.
As a native Norwegian, I've been thinking about what Norwegian film would be most interesting for you guys to check out. Honestly, there's not a lot to choose from. We don't have directors like Andersson and Kaurismäki. But since you guys decided to focus on these directors, I thought the closest you'd get to something of an auteur, and in my opinion, the best you can get from Norway, would be Bent Hammer. Still, I've been listening to you guys for about 7 years and have never written to you. And honestly, I thought you'd just skip Norway altogether in your marathon. Then I took a look on your website and saw that you guys are planning on reviewing Hammer's latest movie, 1001 Grams. Well, I am not a native Norwegian, but I'm maybe 25%, I would say. And my forebears, they might disown me over 1001 Grams. Adam, not a big fan of this one. The film stars Ann Dahltorp as Marie, an inspector at a government agency that, from what I can tell, is responsible for the accuracy of everything from gas stations, gas pumps at fueling stations, to the bounce of sport balls we see at one moment,
yeah.
This being measured in a lab. When Anne is selected to accompany Norway's official kilo, which is kept in two glass bell jars and a concrete case, to this international conference that debates the weight of a true kilo, the experience causes her to evaluate her own life.
Could have avoided a lot of drama here, just drop the whole metric system thing.
That would have helped. The weights and measures, though, Adam.
Yeah.
Oh, the weights and measures. Admittedly, the movie may make a few jokes about the seriousness of the conference attendees who are carrying these kilos around like babies, but it takes its central metaphor very seriously. Think about the frequent helicopter shots that, you know, the movie's very geography is being measured there. There's also dialogue that frequently references weight of some kind. Did you know that life's heaviest burden is to have nothing to carry, Adam?
You have to find balance, Josh.
Okay, so metaphor can be a tricky thing, right? I mean, if it's handled well, it can lend a film a resonant air of poetry. We talked about that quite a bit when we reviewed The Fits lately, but handled poorly, and it can, to use 1001 Grams metaphorical language, it can really weigh it down like a couple of kilos.
How dare you?
What'd you make of Hammer's use of metaphor?
There was a metaphor here?
Okay, I mean,
I'll play along, I guess. I'm not sure starting with a metaphor and building your narrative around that, which is what seems to have happened here, is the best approach. Devising your characters and the plot and everything from this metaphor, definitely starting with a metaphor and then building your narrative around the literal exploration of that metaphor, that's not the best approach. At least I've learned that from this film. It would be like if Inarritu with 21 Grams, which is a movie that does get referenced
yes,
here.
Yes, it does.
Used that metaphor of how much our life weighs. That's the tagline of the movie. How much does life weigh, or what does our soul weigh? Not just as a metaphor to explore the human condition, but was actually about characters who were scientists conducting that type of experiment. There's a conversation that happens outside at one point during this big conference where all the weights and measures people go with their kilos, and you have people articulating the central crux of the film. Someone says something like that we still have a kilo from 1889 that nobody knows the weight of, which makes us unable to determine the weight of any other mass on the planet. It's scandalous. And someone replies, if our kilo isn't the same as yours, it will lead to unrest in the world. So, okay, forgetting international unrest, we get it. If everything that grounds us isn't what we believed it to be or simply ceases to exist, then we as people are thrown into chaos, Josh. We get it. That is what happens to Marie in this film. But after about that first hour, where I would say it relatively subtly explores that metaphor.
And comedically in some ways.
And comedically too. We then get conversations in the last half hour of this movie where a character misuses a French word, and when she's corrected on what the French word means, it actually is a reference to something heavy, like a kilo. And at one point, she has to then articulate that every reference point in my life is crumbling away. That directly mirrors the action we see in this movie. And then later, without getting into spoilers, I'll simply say that she has to go pick something up. And when she picks it up, something very near and dear to her, it's in the exact same shape,
yeah,
and seems to be about the same weight as the kilo she's been carrying around. Again, Hammer just really hammering that metaphor home. And when she has a conversation with a character she develops a little bit of a love interest with, someone from France, he says to her, when everything seems to be spinning out of control, what we are trying to find out, Marie, simply is who we are. And I bring up that line, Josh, only because the whole movie, despite there being some wonderful touches and some really nice comedic moments, and I will get to some things that I really appreciated about the film, it has a philosophy 101 sort of spirit about it, where it's as if this woman, who is obviously very intelligent, it's as if she's never had a self-aware moment in her life. She's never thought of any of this stuff before, which I guess I found a little bit incredulous.
You know, I thought you might bring up Iñárritu, and it makes me
think of... And I didn't even say anything negative about him.
No, well, then I'll keep this brief, because the movie it brought up for me was Locke, the concrete movie that we split on. So that just goes to show that the use of metaphor, the mileage can vary on that. For one viewer and another, it can be overburdensome. And yeah, you know, it does depend on your personal reaction to it. It's not just metaphor on its own. And I do want to say as well that there is some really striking blue-tinged primarily imagery at work here that Hammer has at play. And Torp, I do think she has this brittle sort of bravery in the main role. I think you're spot on in the characterization and how that's handled narratively, but I think the performance is strong. So, you know, Hammer is a filmmaker I definitely still want to explore. And as a matter of fact, the listener from Norway, Eric, I think suggested Kitchen Stories as his strongest work. So at some point, you know, I'd love to get to that.
Yeah, I would too. Kitchen Stories was the movie that I know I wanted to focus on from Hammer and from Norway, but was only available via Facets. That was the only way I could get a copy of that film. So listeners probably couldn't really play along. Now, O. Horton, much more acclaimed, much more well-regarded than this film, even though this was Norway's nominee for Best Foreign Language Film the year it came out. That film is on Netflix, but again, a little bit difficult to see, whereas this movie, 1001 Grams, you could not only get from Netflix, but it was streaming on Netflix as well. So thought that might encourage some participation if you were curious for our rationale behind wanting to take a look at this movie. And you mentioned the look of the film, the blue-tinged quality to it. I responded quite a bit to the way Hammer visually establishes the rigidity and the order in Marie's life. There is that blueness of the lab that she works in that matches a lot of the color scheme we see at her house, suggesting there really is no separation between the two for her. The long, sleek corridors of that lab, the straightness of everything, not just at work, but at home and really everywhere we see her go. All the lines, all the shapes are perpendicular. There's a scene where she's having a conversation with, like, I suppose the head of the institute of the lab that she works in, and he's dwarfed by the bookshelves behind him. All these perfectly ordered books on these perfectly straight lined bookcases that overwhelm him and her. And even when we see overhead shots of streets and roads, they look mostly like grids. Yeah, they look just like the walkways in the lab or where she lives. It's this clear sense of order, at least being attempted, if not being totally achieved. And I think the shot of the movie, Josh, is actually there's a funeral scene where all of the characters at some point, this is like something we'd see out of a Roy Anderson film or Karasmaki. After seeing two films in this marathon from those filmmakers, I feel a little more comfortable saying that, where it's a little bit of physical comedy almost. All the characters in the rain at this funeral walk away in perfect symmetry, one by one, turning a corner and walking away, all carrying the same blue umbrella. Again, this sense of rigidity, this sense of order. Now, that gets balanced by the obviousness of all of those really deep, warm, earthy tones whenever she's in France and she's spending time with the guy who is the opposite of right. all that and brings that out in her. But there are some nice touches here, Josh, in terms of the humor when we see her with her father smoking at work. I love how cramped it is, right, where smoking is this bit of pollution and everything is so sterile and antiseptic in there that they only get this tiny little hovel
yeah.
to smoke cigarettes in. And I laughed as well as we saw, I think, three times her ex-husband, never really mentioned until about halfway through the film, or ex-lover anyway, taking his stuff only whenever she's not around. So she'll come home from a day at work and she can't pull into the driveway because he's there pulling out with something. And there is one moment where she comes home to see him grabbing a painting. And that moment of disconnect and pain is so wonderful and isn't a moment that's explained. Like, so much of this movie is explained. And I think that's why I was so attracted to those moments. And even those moments, Josh, when she is waiting for him, she starts to pull in the driveway. She can't because his car is waiting to pull out. It's this bit of messiness where it's like, they both can't inhabit this space at the same time. There's no way yeah, they'd have
never,
a driveway.
They never have a conversation.
People. Right. They don't. So in this type of instance, when they should have this really messy type of encounter, that's even kept at bay. That can't happen because they just never touch each other. They just wait for the car to pull out and the other car to pull in. So there is a lot to recommend here. It's easy, I suppose, to be a little bit snarky about just how heavy-handed the metaphor is, but there are some really wonderful touches that makes me really do want to see more work from Hammer. 1001 Grams is available to rent on most digital platforms and, as I said, is streaming via Netflix. If you've seen it and agree or disagree with what we had to say, email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
If email isn't your thing, that's okay because we love to get voicemails. You can leave a voicemail at 312-264-0744. If you didn't get that, you can find the number under the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter. Adam is at Filmspotting. I'm at Larson on Film.
We'll be wrapping up the Nordic Marathon in a couple weeks with Rams, a well-received 2015 film from Iceland. That one is also available to rent through most digital platforms. I believe it just came out and you can get it via Netflix as well. And of course, possibly your local library. We're also close to working out the titles for our next marathon, which we should be able to announce in a couple of weeks. I think we're pretty set on it, but we'll let the suspense build for a little bit while longer. Josh, a complete list of marathon titles and previous marathons we have done, over 30 of them, is available at filmspotting.net. Just click on the marathons link at the top of the page.
Also at filmspotting.net, you can find 11 years of reviews, marathons, interviews, and top fives. That's all in the show archives. While you're there, vote in the current Film Spotting poll. We're asking for your most anticipated fall movie that's based on a true story. Of course, if you haven't already, we want to remind you to please check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts. We've got Film Spotting SVU and The Next Picture Show. You can find both in iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
Out in limited release this weekend, Disorder from the director of last year's Mustang. It's a thriller starring Matthias Schoenaerts and Diane Kruger. In wide release, Ben-Hur, Josh's recommended Kubo and the Two Strings, and War Dogs, Jonah Hill and Miles Teller in a true story about a pair of guys who won a contract to arm America's allies in Afghanistan. It's directed by Todd Phillips of Hangover and Old School fame. Next week on the show, it's a big one. It's our 600th episode. We will have a special guest on that episode.
You're not going to say who?
I'm not going to say who.
Can I say who?
No. No, I kind of want to keep it a surprise.
I don't know why. Let's do it.
Okay. Let's go ahead and keep it a surprise. We will have a special guest, a special top five. That is, if we can actually figure out what the topic and criteria for this top five are.
The working title for this top five is, let's just say it's way more than 140 characters.
Way, way more than 140 characters.
We got to work on that.
It's some convoluted, complicated stuff. So we will have maybe some more details about that on social media, or you'll just have to download it and be surprised.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, the show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Our music this week came from the Hell or High Water soundtrack. There's more information at nickcave.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
I saw this correctly, you guys did then end up going to that Shakespeare thing. How was it?
It was really good. Really funny.
What exactly was it?
It was Twelfth Night, but like a 75-minute version. So abridged.
Right in my wheelhouse.
And, yeah, which was nice because it got to be pretty beastly around like 5 o'clock, which is weird. You think it'd be starting to cool off, but all of a sudden the sun came out and we were roasting. But you always think of the actors, right? Including Malvolio was in a tux, a black tux, and he's running around in the crowd. It was really fun because they played up the crowd interaction, as you might expect, played up the broad comedy, the physical humor, used music a lot. So it felt like sort of a Shakespeare primer for people. And in fact, that's kind of how they introduced it too, like asked how many people this is their first Shakespeare mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. So it really worked well as a Shakespeare in the Park experience.
This was our last weekend before the last week of summer. Kids start school on the 22nd, so it was a weekend full of house cleaning. I basically got to all of the things I had to absolutely
literal
get to.
House cleaning?
Yeah,
or
literal
like,
house
okay,
cleaning.
No, right. It was not just taking care of chores.
It was
and
really
paperwork
that.
And okay.
Did you do anything else exciting?
I pulled an Adam on one of the things we watched, The Little Prince, you know, the Netflix
right.
animated
Been
thing.
Meaning to watch it.
Yes. Well, I had to split it up in two viewings, even though it's under 2 hours, because we started it Thursday night. We were going to do this Perseid meteor shower viewing, which was supposed to be – it's every year in August, but this was supposed to be a especially great year. B has been into it because we went to an astronomy program about a month ago. So she talked us into staying up late, and we thought, well, what are we going to do while we're waiting? Midnight was the soonest you could do it. Let's watch The Little Prince. So we started mm-hmm. it, and then by the time midnight rolled around, we're like, let's get out there. This is getting too late. All four of us go up on the roof, laying on a blanket, kind of disappointing. It was a wispy, cloudy night, so I saw two go by. I think B saw one. She claims she saw one. Adeline saw one. Debbie saw one or two. And we packed it in like by 1 o'clock. So that was a little disappointing. I think it was the weather and the light pollution from Chicago, even from where we're at,
yeah,
is ridiculous.
I bet.
So maybe not the best viewing situation. Anyway, we didn't finish The Little Prince at 1 a.m. I wasn't enjoying it quite that much.
I can see that.
So we finished it Saturday night. And you know, it's probably worth catching. They break it up. They've added a narrative framing device to what the 1943 novella is, mm-hmm. that at least it was published in English in 43. And it's a really weird children's novella in the first place. But what's in the novella, they make this paper cut animation that's just gorgeous and some stop motion puppetry too. That's really delicate stuff and amazing to look at. Haven't seen much like it elsewhere. But then this framing device, which is thematically on point. The book's basically about how grown-ups are anal retentive morons. And so this framing device.
Guilty.
Yeah, it sounds familiar. Is about a little girl who's going to start her first day of school at this very prestigious private academy. And her mom is sort of a corporate go-getter, and she's trying to prepare her, has this elaborate schedule for her. So you can see how they both come into play. But that framing device is sort of the traditional boxy CG animation, has some nice touches to it, but nothing really that compelling. And then trying to squish those two plots together doesn't mm-hmm. entirely work. So there's a lot to recommend, but overall maybe not as successful as I might have hoped.
So you talking about the stars reminded me of my vacation. And you don't become fully aware of just how much you're missing out by being, even in the suburbs, and being that close to Chicago and not really seeing the stars at night until you are out in the middle of nowhere and you really yeah. experience it. And one night we did this kayaking tour. It's called Bio Bay. There's this bioluminescent
oh, wow.
bay tour, right, where there are these organisms in the water.
Yeah.
And apparently there are only 5 of these places in the whole world, and I think they said maybe 2 of them are in Puerto Rico. So we were on one of these excursions that takes you out into the water via kayak, and Sarah and I planned this out. Now, I haven't been on a kayak.
I am trying to picture
this. I can tell
this.
You when. I know when it was because it was the first year of Film Spotting. How do I know that? Because Sam and I had just started the show, and the brother, Steve, of the guy who introduced me to Sam, Kevin, my college roommate, and I'm friends with Steve now too, of course, and Sam is as well, Steve was getting married. And so this would have been 2005 or 2006.
Okay.
And they did, instead of a bachelor party, more of a, I think the guy, they went down to Ottawa here, you know?
Yeah, right.
And just camped out, and we kayaked and stuff. Now, I had to work or something that night, so I couldn't stay and really partake in the fun. But I went on the canoeing part anyway, right? And
canoeing or kayaking?
It was canoeing.
They're two different things.
This was well, it's canoeing, but you know, you have to paddle, right?
Yes,
so I don't know what the difference
is.
They both involve paddling.
You're right.
And I know they're hard. And I know that Sam and I spent 2 hours on that water, not paying attention to what we were doing, getting completely separated from everyone else, talking about movies the whole time.
Yeah, I was going to say,
how
many poll questions came out of this kayak trip?
We didn't even really talk film spotting. We just talked movies the whole time. The next thing you know, we're completely separated from everyone else, and we don't know how to steer straight. We didn't know what we were doing. Okay, so that was kind of a bad – I mean, it was fun because I was with Sam, but bad experience on the water.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm starting to have flashbacks. And now you're
out on the ocean.
Yeah, and now they tell us. We're not only out on the ocean, but the trip via kayak out to the bay is 45 minutes.
All right. That's a good trek.
Kayaking for 45 minutes. So we had to fit. They usually fit two.
Doubles, yeah.
Yeah, doubles. But you can fit three in there. And, of course, we have six people in the family. So me being stronger than my wife, we decided to put Sophie with me and put Holden with her. And then I think I got Quinn and she got Connor in the middle. And we start going. And, of course, Sarah.
Everybody in two kayaks. This already sounds like trouble.
And we kind of got separated from each other because you're on the water right away. You're not even in the same kayak and you're floating away and you're drifting or whatever. And we start moving. And I'm aware within the first 30 seconds, Josh, that I have absolutely no clue what I'm doing. Like, they gave us a little demonstration. Most of it went right over my head once I actually got out onto the water. Sarah, meanwhile, being Sarah, everything just
figured
came naturally
it out.
To her. She figured it out.
Yep.
She was a pro. They were fine. Everyone's going one way. We're off the other way.
It's not that hard. What's wrong with you?
Here's the part of that, Josh. You're right. It isn't. I needed someone to just tell me, and then I needed to do it myself. Like, not in a demonstration, but a guy came up, rescued us, one of the guys on the tour, rescued us, and then he basically just laid it out for me in terms of which side you want to do it on, if you're trying to go this way, and how you do an abrupt stop. And once I did it, I was like, okay, not only is this super easy, but it's fun as hell.
Yeah.
And so I had a great time. And on the way back, we were like first in line. We were killing it. We were great.
So good.
I needed that 5-minute
disaster
period.
Did you see the
bioluminescent
organisms?
We did, but it's that 45-minute tour was actually my favorite part of it because I actually, for me, the bioluminescence was a little bit underwhelming. I think I had in my mind, and I don't know why, but I had in my mind this image of you getting out there and just the water underneath you being filled up blue. And if they didn't stop you and tell you that now's the time, you wouldn't even notice.
Got it.
Because you really don't notice until you put your hands in the water.
Huh.
And your movement of the water is what lights them up.
Okay.
And even as you like put your hand in the water and then you lift your arm up and the water drips on your arm, you see the blue and stuff. So it's cool.
It's pretty cool.
But it's not this mind-blowing.
Yeah, I'm thinking of there's like a movie where this like an animated movie where the water somehow – yeah.
Well, it's probably a little bit more enchanting.
Movies ruined real life once
exactly,
again.
Exactly. A little more magical. But that tour out there in the pitch black.
That'd be cool.
In the pitch black – because we did the 8 o'clock tour. Totally dark, 45 minutes on the water, nothing but the sky and the stars, and the kayaks in front of you just have little red lights on the back. That's how you kind of know where you're going.
Well, yeah, it does sound like you could get lost.
And you spend a good chunk of it in – I felt like I was actually in Willy Wonka's chocolate factory when they go on the boat because it's this tunnel. You are enclosed by – branches and you're in a bay.
Okay,
and so at one point you have to get through it to get out into the water. For a good 20 minutes, you're just
how are the bugs?
Kayaking. They didn't bother me, but we took precautions. So at least my wife did. She knew what we were doing. And you're in the dark and you're looking at all the trees and then you can see the sky above you and the stars are insane. And it really was that was the best part of the trip. That wasn't the best part of the whole trip. There was another island excursion that we had, but That 45 minutes on the water was great once I got past.
That sounds amazing. And I'm glad
total
you
failure.
Finally picked up on the kayaking. Although I can't say too much. Debbie and I went one morning. My dad's a big kayaker.
Okay.
So he's got two and he goes on the Chicago River a lot. So he brought them up to this Wisconsin cottage we were at. And one morning, Debbie and I went out early and I had fun. I was in the back, but I heard a lot of grumbling. Every once in a while, my paddle would hit hers or, you know, something like minor like that.
Right.
So I thought we did great. But I also survived tubing every day behind the speedboat.
We did that in Branson.
At 42, I'm pretty proud. No injuries. I'm walking around fine. I mean, I feel like that's now, kind of pushing it.
Now, in fairness, was anybody driving the boat trying to hurt you get you thrown off?
Oh, yeah. It's a family tradition to challenge. And we were jumping from one tube to the next, and it got pretty wild.
So on our trip to Missouri, that's what we did, is we were on the lake every day. My kids just love it.
Yeah, they can't get enough,
right? The more dangerous, the better. And Sarah and I were out there, and I'm the worst. I spent the whole time just going, I'm done. I'm ready to get off.
Like, you did your obligatory dad run, and then you're like, okay, I can say I did it.
Exactly.
I'm done.
Yeah, and then my brother-in-law is trying to kill me, and I don't need that.
I wish I could have seen that.
So haven't really been able to partake in much art outside of the things we're talking about. But the one thing I did want to mention, I only mentioned it really briefly last week with Tasha, but I finally, on the way to Puerto Rico, I put down the laptop long enough to read The Vision.
Yes,
the Tom King
series,
and everybody recommended it on Twitter that they thought it would be kind of in my wheelhouse and that I'd really enjoy it. And I had high expectations because of that, even though I don't read graphic novels or comic books at all, really, not even regularly at all. And it not only met my expectations, it wildly exceeded them.
Nice.
It's amazing. And the conceit of it, which you may know, right, is that the Vision, the character from these movies, decides to start a family and move to the suburbs of Virginia outside D.C. He's going to get a job working at the White House in national security.
Yeah.
But he gets a job like everyone else in D.C. and he raises a family out in the suburbs. And, well, if only it were that simple, right? And all these things go wrong. And just the economy of storytelling, right? They've got the words, they've got the images together. That's pretty powerful. But so much ground is covered in a profound sense, emotionally, intellectually, but also just in terms of plot. So much is covered, and it's covered so, so effectively, so concisely. There's just nothing wasted. And at the end of it, I just couldn't believe how far we went from where we started in that short amount of time. If you read them all together, it won't take you more than probably an hour, but it's remarkable, and the narrative framing device that he uses that I won't spoil, but there's another voice in there that isn't just the voice of a writer. The narrative is being driven by someone, it seems, and as that's revealed and finally revealed at the end, it's really good.
How many are in the series?
The first part of it is just six.
There's six, okay.
That's been released. Now, I think some other – I could be wrong. I haven't been following this close enough, but like – 1 through 6 were put into book form that you can get on Amazon.
Got it.
And it's like $12 or $13. 7 through 12 is coming out, I think, in December. Whether or not some of those issues are already out, I don't know. But the 7 through 12 book form like that is December.
I'll have to get on it.
You will.
Just finished Squirrel Girl, which was pretty good.
No
comic.
Idea what that is.
It's like a Marvel-related thing that was kind of fun. It's like a light take on it. So, I'm looking for a new comic.
Nice. Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.